Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Hi, it's Kelly Campbell. Welcome back to the Legal Nurse Podcast. Today we have Dr. Allison Muller. She's a board-certified toxicologist and registered pharmacist with over 20 years' experience in the field of clinical toxicology. After nearly 20-year career leading the Poison Control Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which included consulting on toxicology cases from 21 counties in Pennsylvania and Delaware, Dr. Muller is presently an independent consultant specializing in providing expert witness testimony on cases involving medications, alcohol, chemicals, and environmental toxins. She is also an adjunct faculty at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine and a founding section editor for the Journal of Emergency Nursing. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to talk with you.
Oh, I tell you what, I have lots of questions. And you know, before I ended up going to perfusion school, I actually was at University of Arizona for pharmacology and toxicology. So So it's pretty fascinating to me. So what made you go into the field of toxicology?
Well, I mean, my undergraduate and my graduate degrees are both in pharmacy. And when I graduated from my undergrad program, I was working at the Poison Control Center here in Philadelphia. It's at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And I really enjoy toxicology. So I really committed my career to toxicology rather than pharmacy. And I did also a doctor of pharmacy degree. And then I did some postdoc work in toxicology, and eventually became director of the Poison Control Center. I was director there for 10 years. I was on staff as one of the poison specialists for 10 years. And so toxicology really is a natural fit for pharmacists and for nurses who have an interest in drugs and chemicals and just really understanding the bad things that can happen to the body with these substances. And most importantly, understanding how we can treat and assess patients that might be poisoned. So I'm very passionate about toxicology. I still keep my pharmacist license, but I haven't filled a prescription in a couple decades. So definitely committed to doing toxicology consulting exclusively.
Well, it's so impressive. I have to tell you, so impressive.
Well, thank you.
Yes. So what type of cases do you work on as an expert witness?
So typical cases would be, let's say, from an attorney who's working on a medical malpractice case. And, you know, to me, it really does not make a bit of difference if it's a plaintiff's case or a defense case. For me, it's just a matter of how can I best explain the science of the case to an attorney and then ultimately to a jury. So a medical malpractice case may be somebody, let's say, who's in the hospital that may or may not have had an adverse effect from a drug, either because there was drug interactions that weren't picked up or the dose was incorrect, or maybe the wrong patient just got the wrong drug, or there's a whole host of reasons why there could be, you know, medication misadventures, either as an inpatient or an outpatient. I also get cases from criminal defense attorneys. Unfortunately, the kinds of cases that are coming up are way too frequent in my area of expertise, and that has to do with the opioid epidemic. Many of these criminal defense cases are due to death due to drug delivery. So somebody who has used the street drug, typically heroin or fentanyl or both, And then trying to really drill down, was that the sole cause of death, or were other drugs on board also responsible? Other criminal defense cases tend to be things like, you know, there's a homicide, but the person has these drugs in the system or takes these prescription medications. What could be the role in their change in behavior and that led to the homicide? And then a lot of personal injury cases. So they may involve drugs, alcohol, or both, where somebody either has, you know, as simple as a DUI with alcohol. I typically don't take those cases because they're frankly not that exciting for me, but I do, you know, take those alcohol-related cases that might be, you know, also drugs involved and saying, what's the role of these drugs in the person's either driving impairment or impairment at the work site, or cases known as dram shop cases where a patron is at a bar and they are potentially being overserved even with visible signs of intoxication, and being able to drill down what the lab results show and what the other patrons have to say about the behavior and the bartender and that sort of thing. So those are the three crux of cases: personal injury, medical malpractice, and criminal defense.
Okay. Do you mind if we break each one down and dissect each one? So for personal injury, how would you go about trying, or from start to finish, personal injury, you would receive a case, whether it's defense or plaintiff? How would you look at the records?
Great question. And I do the same thing for every case, so some of this might be repetitive, but I'll start from the top. So whenever I get a call from an attorney about a case, of course, first I want to make sure that I don't have a conflict, meaning I just need, you know, who the parties are that are involved and all the attorneys involved in the case to make sure that I haven't been contacted by the other side in any way, shape, or form, and I'm not familiar with the case at all. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I also just want a very high level overview of what the case is. I'm not going to get into a half an hour conversation about the case because we're just kind of working in the dark. If I don't have any records in front of me, I'm not going to give opinions on something just based on what the attorney or some other expert has gleaned from the records. So that's the second thing. The third thing is, I will ask the attorney where they are in the process of getting all the materials in discovery for the case. I have cases that are in my office now that are in all different stages. Some cases I might not get all the discovery materials for months. Therefore, my opinion is not going to be ready for months. And so I also want to know what they have and what they're waiting for. And then I may make recommendations to get additional materials. The big one in personal injury cases for me is, I will ask the attorneys if they have historical medical records. So if it's a personal injury case and the patient was hospitalized, of course the attorney is going to have those hospitalization records. But what they don't have sometimes is, they don't have historical records. So I want to really get a lay of the land as to what this person's medical history is. So I want the medical records from their primary care doctor, from their neurologist, any other specialist that they've seen. And then, being a pharmacist, of course I want the pharmacy records. And also, states have something called prescription drug monitoring systems. I also want those data. And these are things that attorneys may not have. The pharmacy records and the prescription drug monitoring data typically are not readily available to me. So they'll say, okay, we'll put that on the list for discovery. So those are all helpful. Once I get all of the materials that they have, and it might not be just, you know, records, it might also be videos or recordings or text messages. I mean, everything should come to me, because it's not up to the attorney to determine what the toxicologist needs and doesn't need, because a lot of times it's not just the medical piece of it, especially because you had mentioned about death cases. Especially with death cases, I need really to understand the circumstances surrounding the death, and, you know, getting crime scene investigation data, and also any statements from bystanders, police reports, like everything. So I have attorneys send me everything. And then I go through all of the records. Now, you know, everybody has a preference. I used to have the preference of having paper records, But then it becomes voluminous. You know, I have boxes and boxes and boxes of paper records, and then I have to, you know, get them professionally destroyed and all that. So now I go through electronic records. And so legal nurse consultants should keep in mind everything that they are noting is discoverable and needs to be shared with the attorney. And so, you know, when I'm deposed on cases, I have, you know, sometimes sheets of notepaper that I've taken notes on cases, and as I'm going through the records, you know, I'll say like page 65, you know, column one, I found this, whatever, because I never want to write directly on the records because I might have to give those back.
Right.
So, you know, they'll get like handwritten pages. So just be mindful what you're writing down, because you need to be giving all of that to the attorney, and then that'll ultimately be shared during deposition. That is as product that you need to produce for them. And so things I'm looking for personal injury cases, I mean, I don't go straight to the labs or the toxicology labs or the postmortem data, you know, the toxicology labs that are done at autopsy. I mean, those are, of course, interesting, and I will certainly look at them, but that doesn't make my opinion one way or the other yet, because one of the things that I stress to attorneys when I'm teaching them also about these types of cases is if all you have is a drug level, all you have is a drug level. You should not be making any hard and fast conclusions just based on a drug level. You need more than that. Because oftentimes the drug levels are showing you, hey, at some point in time, this person used this drug, but is it telling you the dose? Is it telling you when? Is it telling you if they were impaired or not? You need more data. So the summary I would say for personal injury cases, and really all cases, make sure you have everything you need. Make sure the attorney is sharing everything that they have with you, regardless if they think if it's helpful or not, because really they don't have your expertise, so they don't know what you really can find helpful.
Right. That's so valuable. No matter what expert you are, they don't have your expertise. So true.
And I have a professional services agreement that includes a HIPAA agreement. I know it's a separate topic, so I won't get too far into that. But within that professional services agreement that is signed by the attorney prior to me doing anything with the records, doing any sort of review, it does have in there that they would be required to supply me with everything that they have obtained during discovery.
That's very wise. I do the same thing. That's so wise. Okay, regarding the autopsies, and you had mentioned about the drug levels with autopsies. Can you delve a little bit deeper into that?
Sure. So I actually do a one-hour talk for attorneys about these postmortem cases, because there's a lot of misconceptions about postmortem toxicology, and not only in the layperson community, but also in the healthcare provider arena, and things like you know, when you're looking at autopsy reports and the medical examiner is stating what the cause of death is, the medical examiner doesn't necessarily have anything but, and I don't mean to minimize this because autopsy results are huge and the toxicology results are very key, but oftentimes the medical examiner doesn't have everything that you have. The medical examiner doesn't have the hospitalization records or the past medical history or bystander reports or police reports sometimes. So when they're putting the cause of death, you can't take that at face value. Like for example, if I get a case and it says like cause of death, you know, heroin overdose, unintentional, accidental heroin overdose. I don't say, oh, well, the medical examiner said it was accidental heroin overdose, so it must be. No, let's see what was found at the scene. Let's see other data that we can come up with. What other drugs were in the system? Oh, but they had, you know, a host of other drugs. They may have had, let's say, a benzodiazepine on board. They may have had other street drugs on board. I mean, they may have had, you know, fentanyl. So, I mean, there's other things that can come into play, or maybe, you know, the bystanders gave totally different reports in terms of how the person was acting or what their drug use habits were, et cetera. So that's the first thing, not to take that at face value. The medical examiner will give the best answer that he or she can based on what they have. again, it's not fair to say that their answer is the end all be all because they don't have everything that you have. And the second thing is back to interpreting drug levels. So interpreting drug levels in postmortem cases is tricky because people really want to extrapolate retrospectively what a drug level was prior to death. And so, you know, between my undergraduate program and my graduate program, I took 3 semesters of pharmacokinetics. So pharmacokinetics is the science behind, you know, what the body is doing to a drug once it enters the system. And so you can't apply those formulae or any of those principles to patients who are no longer living. So in other words, I can't take, you know, those calculations and figure out what was the dose that they took based on this level. I've seen opposing experts do that, and they clearly have no idea what postmortem toxicology is about if they're using pharmacokinetic calculations for drug levels from dead patients. So that's the first thing. You can't use pharmacokinetic principles and figure these things out for postmortem levels. The second thing is sometimes levels look unexpectedly and falsely elevated because there's all these changes in the body after death. The one thing, and attorneys are very familiar with this too, I love when attorneys are excited about science and can talk science with me, something called postmortem redistribution, which is PMR. And so what that means is things don't stay put after death, and some drugs more than others, many of the opioids are famous with this, like fentanyl, for example. You know, I see a sky-high fentanyl level, I'm like, well, it's high. Was it really this high before death? Or was it because of the postmortem redistribution and things are just shifting around, you know, coming from tissues into the blood, and depending where they drew the sample from a postmortem standpoint makes a difference as well. So not to get too excited about what the levels look like in terms of how high they are. Also, if it's a trauma case, you know, what type of trauma case is it? I mean, if it's something where maybe contents of the gastric cavity could have spilled out into the blood or such, that's a problem with really interpreting levels. I like vitreous humor because vitreous humor is a pretty protected space in terms of getting levels. The problem is we don't always have references that tell us what the different vitreous humor levels mean. The other thing is, and I mentioned this when I spoke at the annual meeting for the Legal Nurse Consultants, is that there's a textbook by a gentleman last name Bestelt, and you know, it's very, very voluminous amount of material in there in terms of how to interpret levels, both antemortem and postmortem. You'll see that there's ranges. You know, it might be death has been reported for such and such drug from 5 nanograms per milliliter to 5,000. Like, I'm being a little exaggerating here, but not by much. So, you know, for someone to say, well, they had a level of 75 and it's in this range, boom, it's, you know, that's the cause of death, is incorrect. You know, there's also all these different charts that'll try and correlate, you know, drug levels with fatality. Versus, you know, therapeutic postmortem drug levels or non-toxic postmortem drug levels. Those are only a starting point. Those are not meant to be, okay, that's the end of the story, we go to these charts. So use them very carefully and don't use them in isolation.
This is Pat Iyer. As an LNC, you're aware of the dangers of anticoagulation with heparin, Coumadin, Lovenox, and other drugs. These drugs have a very narrow window of safety. Even in the best of circumstances, when everybody does everything right, anticoagulation can lead to significant toxicity and bleeding, permanent injury, paralysis, blindness, and death. Your understanding of anticoagulation is useful for attorneys handling these cases. You can be invaluable in helping the attorney understand how they work, the mechanism of interaction, onset, and duration. Using antidotes and recognizing and avoiding drug interactions. Sharpen your knowledge of anticoagulation by purchasing our 1-hour online training called Anticoagulation on the Bleeding Edge. Here, a pharmacology expert witness, Dr. Jim O'Donnell, give tips about how to analyze these cases. Order the program at the show notes for this podcast at podcast.legalnursebusiness.com and use the code LISTENED in the coupon box to get a 25% discount. Now let's return to the show.
Right. And, you know, another book that is coming out by AALNC is the e-book series on the opioid crisis by Sharon Kelly. And I happen to be the peer review for that. And I think that's a very valuable book, too.
You have to tell me a little bit about that. So do they talk about, in the book, do they talk about things related to the toxicology of the opioids?
Yes, and just a little bit. It touches on it, but it's more, you know, the various cases in the opioid crisis and the pharmacokinetics, just a little bit, not near as in-depth as what you're providing. I think people are going to end up listening to this podcast quite a bit because you're touching on things that the legal nurse consultant needs to be aware of. In fact, what are some of the other pitfalls that we need to look for in addition to higher levels or redistribution?
The other piece is, and this goes for really all cases, not just postmortem, but it came to my mind because of a discussion I had with an attorney and I caught this error. Make sure the units are consistent. Like if you're looking at drug levels in the autopsy report, so the toxicology analysis, note the levels, but then any place else that you have documentation of levels, make sure it's the same units. And if it's not the same units, you need to do a conversion. I mean, I've seen that error before where there's a confusion with the units. I mean, I can see how that could happen, but it's a very dangerous mistake to make. So make sure that you're paying attention to units.
Oh, something so little but so big.
So big. I mean, it could be 100-fold difference, you know. I mean, we have to make sure that we're paying attention to the units.
Right, right. Okay. Do you have any other tidbits?
I would also say for postmortem cases, to make sure that you are clear on what all of the results mean in terms of, okay, there's metabolites and then there's parent drug. So I'll give an example, like with morphine. If you have morphine in a postmortem toxicology analysis, you may or may not be able to figure out what was going on. In other words, morphine is a parent drug. So did the person use morphine at the get-go, or did they use heroin, and morphine is one of the two major metabolites of heroin. It's the one that sticks around longer. The other one is the 6-monoacetylmorphine, the 6-MAM, 6-MAM. That doesn't stick around quite as long. And can you tell the difference? And it's hard to figure that out if that's all you have is a morphine level. And I've seen that. I had this one case where the medical examiner, ironically enough, this time the medical examiner had more information than I did, at least in the beginning. Sometimes you don't know what you don't have until you say, wait a second, what did he have exactly or she have? So in this case, the person had morphine postmortem, and the cause of death was listed as, you know, heroin toxicity. And I said to the attorney, I said, I don't know how the medical examiner thinks that this is a heroin overdose because there's morphine. How does the medical examiner know one way or the other if the morphine came from heroin or the morphine came from morphine? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, I don't know either because I can't say that this is a heroin overdose. I mean, it's definitely an opioid because the way the person was found and the timing, all that sort of thing, it was clearly an opioid, but I don't know if it's heroin or morphine. So then I get information that the medical examiner had that I did it, and I get this scene investigation report. There's all these packets at the scene, like on the floor, on the table, in the trash, these glycine packets with this particular little stamp on it, and like street drugs, particularly heroin, they have like brands, like users know, like, okay, I get this brand, I know what kind of dose or what kind of high I'm going to get, I know it's from this dealer. And it was like one of those ones, you even just Google it, I forget what it was, like a Mickey Mouse one, I'm making that up, but something to that effect. And it says like, yeah, like Mickey Mouse, you know, heroin packets, whatever, this, that's what it is. So the medical examiner knew about that at the scene and I didn't know. So I was like, oh yeah, now that makes sense.
Oh, how about that? So you do just have to pay attention then. Well, can you distinguish for us the difference between like hair samples, a blood sample, the different techniques of those type of samples and what that means?
Sure. So that I'll go back to the cases involving living patients. So, I mean, there's pluses and minuses to all of those types of samples. I mean, so we'll start with urine samples for toxicology testing. I mean, the nice thing about urine samples is that you're going to have a longer detection time for drugs and their metabolites if you're testing urine, right? Because things stay in the bloodstream only so long, but they'll stay in the urine longer. So you'll get a longer detection time. So that's the nice thing about urine toxicology testing. The bad thing is that there are numerous ways to try and adulterate, switch, do something to throw the results off of urine toxicology testing. And those are things like, I mean, actually an attorney told me about this one. You can buy synthetic urine off the internet. I mean, it's kind of hard to bring.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I was like, this is what I think I've heard it all. I know it's hard to get somebody else's urine because they're going to test the temperature. You know, they're going to, so in other words, it's going to be different if it's from somebody else unless they gave the sample like right there on the spot, literally. So, you know, it's hard for people to come in with someone else's urine and keep it at the right temperature and that sort of thing. But, you know, people try and add all different things and, you know, pretty low success rate, but still, there's still the chance that the urine could be adulterated. So that's the one problem with urine. So blood is the most accurate. It's obviously the most invasive, but it's the most accurate. But again, the issue is, you know, things don't hang around on the blood as long as they hang out in urine. I get a lot of questions about the hair testing. I don't do a lot with hair testing for my purposes. I mean, it's one thing if you're monitoring people for new and upcoming drug use because, you know, if the drug is going to stay in the hair follicle and they can't like wash it out. So let's say they're in some sort of program where they're being monitored for drug use. Okay, they can get hair samples and as the follicle is growing, they can see if there's any drug in there. The issue for me is that I don't get any data from that other than, okay, they've used the drug at some point in time and they're not clean now because they had nothing in their hair and now they do. But there's not data out there that really connects the dots between levels in hair samples and amount of use or time of use. So it's not like helpful for me. And then of course there's, you know, breath samples and, you know, we're all familiar with the breathalyzer technology that's used for alcohol. And that's actually, I don't know how close they are, but there's a couple companies that are developing, I know one's out in California. They were talking about it at a toxicology meeting last month, a breathalyzer for marijuana.
And that's tricky. Yes.
Yeah, that's tricky because it's not like alcohol where you blow a level, or even if you have a blood level, that's a whole other topic too about marijuana metabolites, and say, oh, this person was impaired based on this level. We have those data for alcohol. We don't have those types of data for marijuana's metabolites. But what it's supposed to do is say, okay, if it's picking up this level of metabolite, we at least know that it's within like the past hour or two, and then they are connecting that to say, all right, if it's, you know, this particular metabolite is being picked up on this breathalyzer, then that means it was a recent exposure. And then they're taking it a step further to say recent exposure, meaning they were intoxicated in the past, whatever the time frame is. So there's still a lot of data that has not been released about that. So stay tuned on that.
Well, you know, that's, now this is disclaimer, personal opinion. I mean, with so many people getting it prescribed for medicinal, you still have those side effects, you know, whether you're driving or not, with a prescription.
And the issue becomes, like here in Pennsylvania, I mean, the level is like incredibly low, it might as well just be zero, that if you're caught with really any trace, essentially, of marijuana metabolites in your system, you're considered impaired. So, you know, maybe you're using medicinal marijuana, but still you shouldn't be driving if it's a certain level. But we don't know what that certain level is. That's the problem. So that's why Pennsylvania has, you know, this very low level, essentially zero. I think it's actually like 0.1. You know, to say if you're above this level, you're impaired, not because there's science to say you're impaired, just because they're saying, you know what, we don't know what the level is, so we're going to say you have any, you're not supposed to be driving. But there needs to be some more refinement to that, but the, you know, there's just not the data that we need to say what that level is. It's very tricky.
It is. And I'm glad there's science coming behind. And again, that's personal opinion based on a friend of mine whose daughter was killed by someone driving while under the influence of pot specifically. So I'll put
that. Oh my goodness.
I know.
And it's so difficult to hold people accountable for this when we don't have data. So we're saying like, we're giving this out as medicinal marijuana, but by the way, we don't know how much it's a problem for you to drive. So you're trying to hold people accountable for something, but you're not giving them information because the information isn't there. Right. So, you know, how much is safe? Is any safe? I don't know. And to hear stories like that is just so disheartening.
I know. And I have to say, this was someone that was not using it medicinally. I don't want to start a controversy to whatever, but yeah, so I'd have my own opinions, you know, but I do have another question for you before we go. I know we're starting to make this podcast longer than what it's supposed to be, but now I've been starting to read that meth is on the rise versus heroin and opioids. Have you started to see or get requests on meth?
I haven't had a lot of methamphetamine only cases. I've had cases, whether they be criminal cases or other like postmortem cases, with methamphetamine being detected along with other drugs. And it's interesting because I just read that, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, about some statistics about how, you know, methamphetamine is on the rise and opioids are somewhat down in certain areas of the country. You know, methamphetamine is one of those drugs where it's not something that comes to mind like heroin or other opioids, where there's, you know, this high likelihood of death with overdose. Overdose of methamphetamine is not benign, don't get me wrong. But typically, if you had to put side by side, an opioid is a lot more likely to cause a fatality than methamphetamine. Again, both dangerous, bad, you know, toxic, but opioids are certainly more toxic in terms of risk for fatality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was just curious if it is, you know, every drug seems to be cyclical with decades, or, you know, like the 70s, then cocaine was, was it the 70s cocaine? I was born in the 70s, but cocaine had its heyday and then was like heroin. And, you know, I was just wondering if meth is now starting to be the trend, because Adderall and, you know, with the millennials, if that's like the socioeconomic difference of Adderall and meth. I was just curious if there was a connection there.
Yeah, and I have to jump through hoops to get the, you know, the pseudoephedrine for my stuffy nose, because, you know, the phenylephrine just doesn't do it and has more side effects. But even though I have to sign my life away to get pseudoephedrine, it doesn't seem like the methamphetamine labs are being shut down. So, you know, I don't know what kind of impact that made. But it's interesting you said about trends. Like, I'll give one kind of pearl, and I talk about this in an hour-long talk, so I'll just make this one statement that, you know, PCP was big in the 70s, right? So I cannot tell you the last time, if ever, I've seen a drug screen with PCP on it that wasn't a false positive. Like, PCP is one of those, oh, it's false positive. I mean, almost always. I mean, if you want to know, you have to do confirmatory tests, but that's one of those things on a drug screen. Like, PCP is not all that common, but it sure is common as false positive.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, it has been a fascinating, the time flew for me. I just, maybe it's because of my University of Arizona and pharmacology toxicology days, but I could just continue talking to you all day. But tell our listeners how we can stay in touch or reach out to you when we have some questions or reach out to you as an expert.
So I have a web page, and instead of like giving you the whole long, you know, web address, the easiest way to find me is just Google Allison Muller toxicologist, and I'll light up like a Christmas tree. You know, my LinkedIn page, my web page, you know, any of my blog posts are on my web page. A lot of these talks that I've mentioned that I do for attorneys have been video recorded and are on my web page. My blog is in the of interest section. And the name of my company is Acri Muller Consulting. That's harder to remember versus just Googling Allison Muller toxicologist. You'll find me. And I consult with attorneys all over the country. So it's not like, oh, wow, I'm not anywhere near Philadelphia. That's fine. I travel. There's a phone. That's fine.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for your time. And listeners, don't forget to tune in next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Oh, it was. Thank you. I learned so much. Stay on, please.
Be sure to check out our featured product, Anticoagulation from the Bleeding Edge. This is a one-hour online training available at the show notes on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Get instant access when you order. And I've got a phenomenal resource for you just waiting on legalnursebusiness.com. My online training and books are designed to help LNCs discover ways to strengthen their skills and their businesses. Check them out at legalnursebusiness.com. Many of us are lifelong learners who enjoy the chance to keep expanding our knowledge, just like the Book of the Month clubs, my membership site, lnceu.com, gives you 2 online trainings every month. We have a yearly payment plan that saves you over $50 compared to paying monthly, and each program is hugely discounted. Look at the options at lnceu.com. And my last website, thelncacademy.com, is the coaching program I offer to a select number of LNCs. You get my personal attention and mentorship so that you can excel and build a strong foundation for your LNC practice. Get all the details at lncacademy.com.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.